I have known a good many golden men in the secondary or unimportant sense. Fine Chinese Hawaiians, excellent Portuguese Chinese, and able Caucasian Hawaiians. But most of them had little concept of what was happening, either in Hawaii or in the world. But the four men of whom I now wish to speak did know, and it is in reference to their knowledge that I wish to end my story of Hawaii, for they are indeed the golden men. In 1946, when the war had ended and Hawaii was about to explode belatedly into the 20th century, Hawksworth Hale was 48 years old. And one morning, when the trade winds had died away and the weather was unbearably sticky, he happened to look into his mirror while shaving, and the thought came to him, "This year I am as good a man as I shall ever be in this life. I have most of my teeth, a good deal of my hair, I'm not too much overweight, and my eyes are good enough to see distances without glasses, though close up I have a little trouble, and I suppose I'll have to see an oculist. I can still concentrate on a problem, and I derive pleasure from control of business. I like to go to work, even on mornings like this." He pummeled his midriff to start perspiration before entering the shower, and as the hot, muggy day closed in upon him, he was forced to inspect the two areas in which he was no longer so good a man as he once had been. First, there was the gnawing, never-ending pain that started when his son Bromley was shot down during the Great Fire of Tokyo in 1945, when the Air Corps practically destroyed the city. More than 70,000 Japanese had died in the great raids, and a city too, so that in one sense Bromley's death had contributed positive results, and after his raids victory for our side was assured. But Bromley Hale was a special young man. Everyone said so, and his departure left a gap both in the Hale family and in Hawaii that would never be filled. For in his last letters home, when capricious death had become so routine in his B-29 squadron as to depress all the flyers, he had spoken intimately of what he hoped to accomplish when the war ended, as soon it must. He had written, from a hut on Iwo Jima, "We had to ditch our monstrous plane in the waters near here, and by the grace of God we were all saved. But in the going down, as I worked with the wheel, I was not so much concerned about a perfect water landing as I was with my determination to do what years ago I had sworn to do while a senior at Punahou. I am determined to write a novel about, and this may stagger you, but bear with me, Aunt Lucinda Whipple. I shall have her sitting in the late afternoons in her house in Uwano Valley, and each day as the afternoon rains sweep down from the poly and the white mildew grows on all things, she entertains the straggling members of our family. It has always seemed to me that Aunt Lucinda was everybody's aunt, and everybody comes to her and listens to her monotonous chatter about the old days. And nothing I write will make any sense at all, only an old woman's ceaseless vanity, until it begins to weave a spell, the kind of spell in which you and I have always lived. I shall show Aunt Lucinda exactly as she is, religious, family-proud, unseeing, unknowing, garrulous, and unbelievably kind. She has become to me a web, a fatal emanation, an encroaching dream. And as our plane struck the water, I was listening not to my co-pilot, who was frantic as hell, but to dear old Aunt Lucinda. How she hated airplanes and fast automobiles and Japanese. As a matter of fact, if you took time to analyze it carefully, I guess she hated everybody but the Whipples and the Jandreses and the Hales and the Hewletts and the Hawksworths. But even they gave her a lot of trouble, for she always took great pains to explain to visitors that she came from the branch of the Whipple family that had never had even a drop of Hawaiian blood. And she kept segregated in her mind those of her great family of whom this could not be said. She was suspicious of you and me because we were not pure English stock. And, of course, all the Hawksworths and half the Hewletts were contaminated. And often when I spoke with her, she would hesitate, and I knew she was thinking, I'd better not tell him that, because, after all, he is one of the contaminated. And from Aunt Lucinda's endless vagaries, I want to construct an image of all Hawaii and the peoples who came to build it. I want to deal with the first volcano and the last sugar strike. You may not like my novel, but it will be accurate, and I think that counts for something. It is strange. I have been writing about Aunt Lucinda as if she were dead, but she is living, and it may be I who shall be dead. This dreadful hurt never left Hawksworth Hale's heart, and he started listening to Aunt Lucinda's meanderings, and he picked up the thoughts that his son had laid down. We live in a web. Sugarcane, Hawaiian ghosts, pineapple, ships, streetcar lines, Japanese labor leaders, Aunt Lucinda's memories. The web became most tenuous, and at the same time most cruelly oppressive, when it involved the upstairs rooms where several of the great families kept the delicate women whose minds had begun to wander past even the accepted norm. And in one such room, Hawksworth's own wife passed her days. In the 1920s, at Punahou, Malama Janders, as she was then, had been a laughing, poetic young lady, interested in music and boys. But as the years passed, and especially since the 1940s, her mind lost its focus, and she preferred not to try understanding what had happened to her son Bromley or what her dashing daughter Noelani was doing. Her only joy came when someone drove her up Nu'uana Valley to Aunt Lucinda's, and there the two women would sit in the rainy afternoons talking of things that never quite got into sequence, and neither cared. For generations, the missionaries had railed against Hawaiians for having allowed brothers to marry sisters, and on no aspect of Hawaiian life was New England moral judgment sterner than on this. "It puts the Hawaiian outside the pale of civilized society," Lucinda Whipple's ancestors had stormed, particularly her great-grandfather Abner Hale. And yet, the same curse had now overtaken her own great interlocking family. Whipples married Janderses, and Janderses married Hewletts. And if full brothers and sisters did not physically wed, intellectually and emotionally they did, so that a girl named Jerusha Hewlett Hawksworth was practically indistinguishable either in genes or ideas from a Malama Janders Hale, and each stayed mostly in an upstairs room. In 1946, therefore, except for the death of his son and the slow decline of his adored wife, Hawksworth Hale was truly as good a man as he would ever be. But those two bereavements oppressed him and prevented his enjoyment of the last powerful flowering of his talents. He therefore turned his whole attention to the government of the Hawksworth and Hale Empire, and as the critical year started, he relied more and more upon two stalwart resolves. "I will not give labor an inch, not another inch, especially when it's led by Japanese who don't really understand American ways. And we have got to keep Hawaii as it is. I will not have mainland firms like Gregory's elbowing their way in here and disrupting our Hawaiian economy." Behind him, to back up these two mighty resolves, he had the entire resources of H&H, totaling some $260 million, and all the managerial strength of J&W, now worth more than $185 million. Lesser outfits like Hewlett and Son had to string along, for all saw in Hawksworth Hale the cool and able man, one above the passions of the moment, who could be depended upon to preserve their way of life. Only in his understanding of what was happening should Hawksworth Hale be considered a golden man. Racially, he was mostly Haole. Emotionally, he was all Haole, and he thought of himself in that way. Actually, of course, he was 1/16th Hawaiian, inherited through the Ali'i Nui Noelani, who was his great-great-grandmother. He was also part Arabian, for one of his European ancestors had married during the Crusades, part African through an earlier Roman ancestor, part Central Asian from an Austrian woman who had married a Hungarian in 1603, and part American Indian through a cute trick that an early Hale's wife had pulled on him in remote Massachusetts. but he was known as Pure Howley, whatever that means. In 1946, Hong Kong Ki was 5 years older than Hawksworth Hale, which made him exactly 53, whereas his grandmother Nguyễn Xin was 99. This was not a particularly good year for Hong Kong, because in following his grandmother's urgent advice, buy every piece of land that frightened Howleys want to sell, he had somewhat overextended himself, and frankly did not know where he was going to find tax money to protect the large parcels of land on which he was sitting. Real estate had not been doing well. The anticipated boom in tourists had not yet materialized, and there was a prospect of long strikes in both sugar and pineapple. He had 7 children in school, 5 in mainland colleges and 2 at Punahou, and for a while he considered abruptly cutting off their allowances and telling the boys to get to work and help pay taxes. But Nguyễn Xin would not hear of this. Her counsel was simple. Every child must have the very best education possible. Every piece of land must be held as long as possible. If this means no automobiles and no expensive food, good. We won't ride and we won't eat. The Ki Hui was therefore on very short rations, and Hong Kong sent a form letter to all the Kis studying on the mainland, his own and others. I will be able to pay only your tuition and books. If you are running an automobile, sell it and go to work. If you are faced by the prospect of spending 2 or even 3 more years in college under this plan, spend it. But for the time being, there can be no more money from Hawaii. The decision that hurt him most involved his youngest daughter, Judy. You have to cut out private singing lessons, he told her, and it was sad to see her obey. And then, when things were already difficult, Hong Kong surreptitiously heard that a well-known firm of mainland private detectives was investigating him. He picked up a rumor of this from one of the Qing clan, who had been asked a good many questions about real estate deals, and the interrogation had made no sense until a few days later, when Liu Qing suddenly thought, "My God, every one of those deals involved Hong Kong Ki," and he felt obligated to lay this circumstantial evidence before his friend. Hong Kong's first reaction was, "The income tax people are after me." But reflection assured him that this was ridiculous, for certainly the government never used private detective agencies when they had such good ones of their own. This conclusion, however, left him more bewildered than ever, and gradually he came to suspect that the fort had deduced that he might be overextended and was collecting evidence which would enable them to squeeze him out once and for all. He judged that the mastermind was probably Hawksworth Hale. His first substantial bit of evidence came, curiously, not from the Chinese, who were adroit in piecing together fragments of puzzles, but from his friend Kamajiro Sakagawa, whom he had helped establish in the supermarket business. Squat little Kamajiro bustled in one afternoon to announce bluntly, "Hong Kong, you better watch out. I think you in big trouble. Dick from the mainland come to dis rock, asked me about you, how I get my land. By later, he go into the building H&H. "This detective, he has no reason to bother you, Kamajiro," Hong Kong assured him. "Our deal is perfectly good." "What's the matter? Dey catch you from Texas?" "Mine are okay. How about yours?" "Mine okay too," Kamajiro assured him. "Then don't you worry, Kamajiro. Let me worry. This has to do only with me." "You in special trouble?" the Japanese asked. "Everybody's always in trouble," Hong Kong assured him. But what precise trouble he himself was in, Hong Kong could not discover. In succeeding days, he caught various reports of the detectives and their work. All aspects of his varied business life were under surveillance. He never spotted any of the detectives himself. And then, suddenly, they vanished, and he heard no more about them. All he knew was, "Somebody knows almost as much about my business as I do, and they're reporting to Hawksworth Hale." He did not sleep easily. In another sense, these were exciting times, for unless everything that Hong Kong and his grandmother had concluded from their studies was false, Hawaii had to be on the verge of startling expansion. Airplanes, no longer required for warfare, were going to ferry thousands of tourists to Hawaii, and many new hotels would be required. On the day that the boom started, the builders would have to come to Hong Kong, for he had the land. And he felt like a superb runner on the eve of an Olympics, which would test him against athletes whom he had not previously encountered. He was a good runner, he was in tense condition, and he was willing to trust the morrow's luck. Even so, he took the precaution of discussing the detective mystery with his grandmother, and she pointed out to Hong Kong, "These are the years when we must sit tight. Wait. Wait. That's always very difficult to do. Any fool can engage in action, but only the wise man can wait. It seems to me that if someone is spending so much money to investigate you, either he fears you very much, which is good, or he is weighing the prospects of joining you, which could be better. Therefore, what you must do is wait. Wait. Let him make the first move. If he is going to fight you, each day that passes makes you stronger. If he is going to join you, each day that you survive makes the cost to him a little greater. Wait." So, through most of 1946, Hong Kong waited, but without the confidence his grandmother commanded. Each day's mail tortured him, for he would sit, staring at the long envelopes, wondering what bad news they brought. And he dreaded cables. But as he waited, he gathered strength, and as the year ended and his mind grew clearer and his financial position stronger, he began to resemble the golden man of whom the sociologists had spoken. Hong Kong thought of himself as pure Chinese, for his branch of the family had married only Hakka girls, and whereas there were a good many Kis with Hawaiian and Portuguese and Filipino blood, he had none, a fact of which he was quietly proud. Of course, from past adventures of the Ki Hui, Hong Kong's ancestors had picked up a good deal of Mongolian blood, and Manchurian, and Tartar, plus a little Japanese during the wars of the early 1600s, plus some Korean via an ancestor who had traveled in that peninsula in 814, augmented by a good deal of nondescript inheritance from tribes who had wandered about southern China from the year 4000 BC on. But nevertheless, he thought of himself as pure Chinese, whatever that means. In 1946, young Shigeo Sakagawa was 23 years old, and now a full captain in the United States Army. He was 5 feet 6 inches tall and weighed a lean 152 pounds. He did not wear glasses and was considerably better coordinated than his stocky and somewhat awkward peasant father. He had a handsome face with strong, clear complexion and very good teeth. But his most conspicuous characteristic was a quick intellect, which had marked him in whatever military duties he had been required to perform. The 3 citations that accompanied his army medals spoke of courage beyond the call of duty, but they were really awards for extraordinary ability to anticipate what was about to happen. In the memorable victory parade down Kapiolani Boulevard, Captain Shigeo Sakagawa marched in the third file, behind the flag bearers and the colonel. His feet, hardened from military life, strode over the asphalt briskly, while his shoulders, accustomed to heavy burdens, were pulled back. This brought his chin up, so that his slanted Japanese eyes were forced to look out upon the community in which they had not previously been welcome. But when he heard the thundering applause, and saw from the corner of his eye his bent mother and his stocky, honest little father, accepted at last, he felt that the struggle had been a good one. Tadao was dead in Italy, and Minoru, the stalwart tackle, was buried in France. Goro was absent in Japan helping direct the occupation, and the family would never be together again. The Sakagawas had paid a terrible price to prove their loyalty, but it had been worth it. When the marchers were well past the spot where the elder Sakagawas and other Japanese were weeping with joy, the parade reached the old Iolani Palace, seat of Hawaii's government. And for the first time, it looked to Shig Sakagawa like a building which a Japanese might enter, just like anyone else. "This is my town," he thought, as he marched. But when he reached home after the parade and saw the photographs of dead Tad and Minoru on the wall, he covered his face with his hands and muttered, "If we Japanese are at last free, it was you fellows who did it. Jesus, what a price!" He was therefore embarrassed when his father, still fascinated by military life, fingered his medals and said in English, "Like I tell before, they got no soldiers mo better Japanese." "I wasn't brave, Pop. I just happened to see what was going to happen." "Suppose you saw, how come you not run away?" Kamajiro asked. "I was Japanese, so I had to stay," Shig explained. "Too much at stake. I swallowed my fear, and for this they gave me medals." "All Japan is proud of you," Kamajiro said in Japanese. "I'm glad the Emperor feels that way," Shig laughed, "because I'm on my way to help him govern Japan." Shigeo's mother screamed in Japanese, "You're not going away to war again, are you? Goro's already in Japan, and I pray every night." "There's no war," her son explained warmly, clutching her affectionately by the arm. "I'll be in no danger, neither will Goro." "No war?" Mrs. Sakagawa asked, startled. "Oh, Shigeo, haven't you heard? Mr. Ishii says..." "Mother, don't bother me with what that crazy Mr. Ishii dreams up." Nevertheless, Mrs. Sakagawa summoned her daughter and Mr. Ishii, and after the wiry little labor leader had carefully inspected all the doors, to be sure no Howleys were spying, he pulled down the shades and whispered in Japanese, "What I told you last week is true, Kamajiro-san. Under no circumstances should you allow a second son to go to Japan. He will be killed, just like Goro. For everything we have heard is a lie. Japan is winning the war and may invade Hawaii at any moment." Shigeo thought his brain had become unhinged, and he caught Reiko's hand, asking, "Sister, do you believe your husband's nonsense?" "Don't call it nonsense," Mr. Ishii stormed in Japanese. "You have been fed a great collection of lies. Japan is winning the war and is accumulating strength." "Reiko," her brother insisted, "do you believe this nonsense?" "You'll have to forgive my husband," the dutiful wife explained. "He hears such strange reports at the meetings." "What meetings?" Shigeo demanded. That night, Mr. Ishii and his sister showed him. They took him to a small building.